Stem Fatale.
Yeah, this is Stem Fatale. Fatale?
Is it a fatale? No, I think it's...
Fatale.
No, probably not. The Italian version, no. Yeah, it's Stem Fatale.
Nice.
A women in science history podcast.
Yeah, the first one in history.
I think there's like two others I found on.
Alright, see, this is why we're doing this, so we can learn about women in science history and women in science history podcasts.
Yeah. The history of women in science history podcasts.
Yeah.
So I'm Emlyn.
And I'm Emma. And we're your
co-hosts.
Yeah.
We have very similar names. I'm Emlyn like Gremlin.
And I'm Emma like Dilemma.
So this podcast is just because we feel like we know very... So we're both PhD students in an ecology, evolution, and behavior department. And I feel like I know nothing about women in science, like back in the day in a historical context.
Yeah, I feel like in every science class I've ever taken, we learn about the same... like 10 male scientists over and over again.
And like I know like
Rosalind Franklin.
Yeah. And Marie Curie.
Yeah.
And like I have a vague understanding of what they've done.
No. Well, you know what? We're all learning, and that's our first lesson today is even people getting their PhDs are still learning.
You seem so upset with me. Oh no. Not even.
No.
Yeah, we'll work on it. Yeah. Well, hopefully this will help.
Yeah, it will.
Yeah.
No, I'm excited. Yeah, you know, we've been in the field, I guess, I don't know, we're both under 30, but we've been, like, studying biology at least for, like, 10 years now, probably, and other sciences our whole lives, and it's kind of just, like, there should be more representation of women in science history.
Yeah.
Or examples that we can turn to.
Yeah, for sure. So, that's what we're going to try to do.
Yeah. So I guess the format.
Yeah, let's go over it.
Yeah. Well, like.
So I think we're going to switch off every week, and one person is going to tell the other person about a historical woman in science. And that's going to be kind of the longer portion.
Yeah, like a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other part is going to be kind of shout outs to...
just like current women making history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of cool science ladies now that maybe aren't as famous as, you know, some of the big science communicators like Neil deGrasse Tyson or Bill Nye. Mm-hmm. So we just sort of want to make all of science more public, and women in science more public.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are our goals. We will outline them at the beginning of every podcast. But,
just for the first one.
Yeah.
Okay, so should we start?
Yeah, okay. I guess so.
Okay, so I'm starting. Emlyn Gremlin is starting this week, and I'm going to start out with a poem.
Oh, yes. I'm really glad we decided not to make this
not explicit.
PG. Yeah. I've already said. So that was that.
Okay. Now to my poem.
Yes.
She shells.
No.
I had to go to I was at speech therapy for, like, 3 years in elementary school, so this poem is very
traumatic
for me.
Why you do that to yourself?
Okay. She sells seashells on the seashore. Seashells, I'm sure. For if she sells seashells on the seashore, then I'm sure she shells.
I don't know why you do this.
Shells.
Bye. That is Stem Fatale.
And we're done. Okay,
oh,
so this was a tongue twister. written by Terry Sullivan in 1908, and it's inspired by the woman scientist I'm going to talk about today.
Woo! Nice.
So we went through that for
no
a reason.
No way!
Uh-huh.
That poem was inspired by a female scientist?
Uh-huh.
Wow! That's pretty cool. I had no idea.
So, I think the London Natural History Museum has claimed her to be the greatest fossilist the world ever knew. Do you know who I'm going to talk about?
Fuck no. I'm ashamed. Listeners, I'm ashamed, but I don't know who that is.
Do you know who Mary Anning is? Who's in our theme song.
Go on. Why don't you tell me?
Okay. So, Mary Anning.
That's good.
Was born in Lyme Regis in Dorset, England, so it's like southern England. And her father was a cabinet maker, but it seems from what I've read that he didn't really care about cabinet making and just decided to mostly spend his days looking for fossils on the shore.
Well, he could care about both.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like he did.
Okay, yeah.
He could, but I don't think he did. So, yeah, so he spent his time mining the coastal cliffside fossil beds near Lyme Regis and selling
Lyme Regis?
Yeah, so Lyme Regis is a town in southern England.
Okay.
I've actually been there.
Aww.
Yeah.
Nice.
So Mary Anning and her parents lived in a house that was so close to the sea in Lyme Regis that when storms came, their houses would get completely flooded, and apparently at one time they had to go up to the upstairs bedroom and then climb out a window to get
out. Oh my god.
To escape being drowned. So I think it was kind of a precarious place to live. And apparently the house was also across the street from the jail.
Oh.
And also across from the stocks. So like a really good, safe area, all in all.
Oh my gosh.
And then,
the stock market?
The stock market. She was born in 1799.
Oh.
So, no.
The stocks.
Like where the where you put your head in.
Oh. Shit.
Yeah. The stocks.
Wow. So she is like this morbid.
Yeah. So it doesn't seem like great.
A lot of like different interests. Yeah. That's a scene where it all comes from.
Yeah. So, her parents, Richard and Molly, they had 10 children.
No.
However, so I thought when I was reading about this that Mary, there was a Mary that was the oldest daughter, but she got burnt up.
Burnt up?
Yes, burnt up. And so the Mary Anning that we talk about is the young, like one of the younger ones that they then named after the older one that died up, which is like, why would you do that? I guess I'm like memory.
Give her own name.
So there's like multiple Marys that died, and then they just kept naming them Mary.
Oh no! How could you not say Mary Anning and just think of your burnt?
I know.
Oh.
Yeah. So, but apparently, so they had 10 children, and only 2 of them survived.
That was then.
Oh my god, so many.
That's why you have so many.
How many months of pregnancy is that?
90?
Yeah, that's easy math. Good job.
PhDs here.
So, yeah, so so I think it's pretty traumatic. Like, you can.
But also, like, pregnancy is, like, more than just 9 months, right?
Biologists
like
here.
After you have the baby, you're just like, it's still there. It's still
so,
a parasite.
So motherhood.
But I love babies.
Parenting is definitely more than 9 months.
Yeah. Well,
pregnancy,
yeah.
Okay. Pretty sure 9 months.
Not worth saying.
Okay, so when Mary Anning, the one that didn't burn, the younger one, the one
right.
We're interested
right.
in.
Yeah, I'll just assume you're talking about that Mary Anning.
Yes. From now on. When she was 15 months old, I guess she was like a sad, sickly, she was like born too early and wasn't doing that well. But I guess an event occurred that became part of local lore in Lyme Regis. So her neighbor
was taking care of her. So this neighbor, Elizabeth Hastings, was taking care of her and holding her and was standing with two other women under an elm tree watching this, like, strange equestrian show that the whole town had gone to see, that was put on by a traveling company of horsemen. I don't know. That's all I know.
Why doesn't that still happen? I need that in my life.
I know somebody who's taking horseback riding lessons right now.
It's different.
I know. Okay. Anyways. So Elizabeth Hastings is holding Mary Anning, who's this 15-month-old baby, under this tree, and then lightning struck the tree, and it kills all three women.
What?
And
oh
my
God.
But I guess, like, Elizabeth Hastings falls over and still holding this baby. And onlookers rushed the infant home, where she was put in a hot water bath and I guess revived. And the local doctor declared her survival miraculous. And her family said that she was a sickly baby before, but then afterwards seemed to blossom. And so for years afterward, members of her community would attribute Mary Anning's curiosity, intelligence, and lively personality to the fact that she was electrocuted by lightning.
Oh my God, that's like so sweet and traumatizing at the same time.
Yes.
Wow,
so this is kind of her backdrop. She's living in this kind of shitty house. She has 8 deceased brothers and sisters.
Oh.
She was electrocuted. And then her family, to add insult to injury, her family was part of the Dissenters Church, which by the name of it seems like somebody's going to be mad at you.
Right.
Yeah.
Like they've left.
The Church of England. So the Church of England was kind of pissed. But there was a lot of things that I think you couldn't go, if you were one of the dissenters, you couldn't go to college, you couldn't. There's a bunch of restrictions on you by the Church of England because you were a dissenter and they didn't like you.
Gosh.
So she wasn't able to have any sort of, like, real schooling, and her education was very limited and consisted of going to Sunday school, which apparently for the dissenters was mostly teaching them how to read and write.
Oh, so
which seems pretty good.
School.
Yeah, versus,
yeah,
like, religious teaching, it's mostly just, like,
yeah, like,
here's how to read and write. These are very practical skills. And this made me kind of sad. So I guess books are really expensive during this time. And her prized possession was this bound volume of the Dissenters Theological Magazine and Review, which her family's pastor had written a couple articles in. And one consisted of how God had created the world in 6 days.
Oh.
So this is like of the, she has nothing to read except this one book. So half of it's about how God created the world in 6 days. And the other part urged dissenters to study the new science of geology. It's interesting.
Wait, when did they really discover... Oh, this is a bad... I know neither of us know this.
Oh, so, yeah.
Okay, the 1800s, they discovered the Earth was really old, right? Because Darwin used that.
This is before Darwin.
Right. But he used that to form his theory of evolution by natural selection.
Yeah, and I think at this time, people thought that the world was 4,000 years old.
Yeah, okay.
God created it in 6 days.
Oh.
All the animals came.
Yeah.
Then Jesus, and then present. Like, that's history.
Right. Guys, Earth is billions of years old. I don't know. It keeps me awake at night sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, so she was getting educated, essentially.
Yeah.
Even though it was
pretty...
She didn't have a formal education. She was able to read and write. And the two things she read were about the creation of the world and about how you should study geology.
Yeah.
And so by the late 18th century, so apparently Lyme Regis was kind of a shithole for a while. Like, there was trash, you couldn't look out your windows, there was so much trash. But then someone decided that salt water was really good for your health. And so then Lyme Regis became, like, one of those places that people go to, like,
bathe.
And, I read about some weird things where there's, like, if you're a modest woman, they have these, like, cabins that they put into the water so you could, like, bathe in the water without anyone seeing, and, like, boats had to be 100 yards away from any of these, like, wood bathing bins.
Whoa.
Anyways, so Lyme Regis had become a popular seaside resort, and increasing numbers of wealthy and middle-class tourists had arrived there. And even before Mary was born, locals supplemented their income with selling these, like, curios or these fossils to visitors. And so these were fossils with colorful local names such as snake stones, which are ammonites. Devil's fingers, which are belemnites. Do you know what belemnites are?
No,
I think I looked it up, and they're like squid. I could get this wrong, but I think they're squid.
Boners?
No. What? No. They're squid fossils. That was the word. I had just said it. Squid fossils.
Okay.
Squid boners?
Like fossils.
Those would be devil's fingers. Squid boners.
Yeah.
And vertebraries, which is not a very clever name for vertebra. And also some of these fossils were attributed medicinal and medical properties. A lot of them were like, do you have erectile dysfunction? We can fix that.
Still
crush up this crush up this fossil. Mary Anning, it was lucky that she was there because Lyme Regis is one of the best preserved areas to find fossils, like, in the world.
Wow.
And so the coastal cliffs of Lyme Regis are really rich in fossils, and this area is part of a geological formation known as Blue Lias, which is made of alternating layers of limestone and shale, so both of those kind of crumble pretty easily, that was laid down on a shallow seabed during the Jurassic period. And this is one of the richest fossil locations in Britain. And these cliffs are super unstable, so I think they're like 150 feet tall, but they kind of are cavernous, so they go up, and then there's like this cliff edge that overhangs.
Wow.
So they're really dangerous too. And during wintertime, when it often rains, there are frequent landslides that expose new fossils, and whenever there are storms, it exposes new fossils, so there's always new fossils every time there's a big storm. And Mary Anning's father often took his remaining two children, so Mary and I think the oldest, Joseph, fossil hunting expeditions to make money for the family. And this was during the French Revolutionary War, so there was food shortages in England, and so they were super, super poor, and there were a lot of riots about the rising price of bread. They weren't doing great, essentially.
Yeah.
So they're really,
life just sounds so kind of magical, and I don't know.
I mean, like, I don't think magical.
I don't know, all the fossils. I'm just, like, imagining her going to sleep at night dreaming of fossils.
Okay, if you take out the fossils, though, it kind of sounds terrible.
Shit.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to drink some more of this.
Okay, yeah.
Because I need
it. Do you want, we can pop, or?
No, let's just keep going.
Okay.
I'm just going to pour a little of this. So as I said, the family were religious dissenters, and that wasn't great back then. And they didn't follow the Church of England, which meant they were discriminated from, and so they had a really hard time. And then her father died in 1810 of tuberculosis and injuries from a rock, like some of the cliffs falling on him. So he like got knocked unconscious and was sick, and then got tuberculosis and then died.
Okay.
And so this left his family.
I say rocks falling on you, just kill me then.
yeah, that's a quicker way to go. So the family was in a lot of debt, and so they continued to search for fossils to try to sell them and to make money during that time. And so in 1811, so the year after her dad died, Mary was 12, and her brother went out to go collect some fossils and dug up a 4-foot ichthyosaur skull. But they didn't know what it was. They thought it was just a really big crocodile skull.
Oh my.
And so nobody was really even impressed. They were just like, oh, this is cool. But we like find, you know, this all the time, I guess. I don't know why there's so many crocodile skulls.
In England?
Yeah. Which you think would still be cool because there's no crocodiles in it. But no, I guess people weren't that impressed. But a few months
later. That's crazy.
Yeah. So also 4 feet is just the head.
Oh my god.
Can you imagine, like,
digging that up? That's way bigger than any crocodile, right?
Yes.
Like, head.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I think they can get pretty big.
Yeah.
But I would still think you'd be excited.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they were excited, but, so...
Yeah, how did they know they weren't excited?
I don't know. This is what
I read.
But a few months later, Mary went out and she was trying to find the rest of the skeleton that her brother wanted her to find. And she actually did find it. It was clear once they started digging out the bones that this was something that they did not know what it was. Which, like, can you imagine? And I think it was, like, 17 feet long.
Oh, wow.
And you have no idea. You're like, this is nothing that we know what it, like, know about.
I guess at that time, people had explored enough of the world to know, like, a lot of the animals that lived on Earth.
Yeah.
But most of them still weren't categorized, right?
So, yeah, but at least in Britain.
That's such a big animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At least this isn't...
Wow.
If it was something that was somewhere else, at least it wasn't somewhere that was in Britain.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Anything like that, even now.
Yeah. So, I guess this whole area was owned by this guy named Henry Host Henley.
No.
It's a mouthful. And he was the lord of the manor near Lyme Regis. And so so they dug this whole, it was an intact skeleton of something they didn't know what it was. And he paid them $23 for it, which apparently is a lot of money. Back in the day.
Yeah.
In, like, the 1800s, like
what
the 1800s.
Like $300 now?
I don't know. I have a conversion. So £23.
Okay.
Not dollars. But I guess 400 pounds is the equivalent of 26,000 pounds now. Or
no.
In 2010. So
no.
So 23 pounds was quite a bit of money.
Okay.
And so in turn, he sold it to William Bullock, which was a well-known collector who displayed it in London.
Yeah.
In something that would best resemble, like, a natural history museum. I don't think they had a natural history museum at the time. And there it generated considerable interest because, at the time, most people in England believed in the biblical account of creation.
Right.
And this didn't fit into that because they didn't know what it was, and it seemed like something that didn't exist now. And it implied that the earth was... So the account of creation implied that the earth was only a few thousand years old, and this fossil skeleton raised the questions about the history of living things on life itself. So this is before Darwin, so there's no evolution.
Right.
So Earth is super young. Everything was created all at
once.
There is no change.
Would you believe it, or would you be like, someone is tricking me?
I have no idea.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, because I can imagine someone pulling up some, like, crazy thing now, and I'm just like,
yeah. Like, that little alien skeleton with the cone head. No. Chile.
Yeah.
I think. Which looks fake, but it just turned out to be a human.
Some messed up head.
But I remember seeing that for the first time and being like, I think it's a hoax.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why do you kind of think it's a hoax, or... I don't know
what
I would think.
It's huge.
Yeah.
But so this was this fossil skeleton was later sold for £45 at some auction, and it was called the crocodile in a fossil state. So people still, I think, weren't necessarily convinced that it was something new, but, like, if you, it had flippers, so it was like a crocodile head and then, like, a big fish body, and then, like, dolphin flippers. So it doesn't...
That's so cool.
And so, yeah, the British Museum bought it, and Charles Koenig, I guess, suggested the name Ichthyosaurus for it. And this finding raised questions in both scientific and religious circles about this new science of geology and what it was revealing about ancient life and the history of the Earth.
Amazing.
So, like, already her first... She's 12... Her and her brother find this, and it's religious people are questioning their views, scientific people are questioning their views. And so in 1820, the family is again deep in poverty, and they haven't found any major fossil discoveries for a year. And they're at the point where they're starting to sell furniture to pay for their rent, And then this guy, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas James Birch, who was a wealthy fossil collector and one of the family's keenest customers, auctioned off all of his fossils that he purchased from the family in the hopes on their behalf. And so he raised 400 pounds, which is what is worth 26,000 pounds now.
Wow.
And it's unclear how much the family got from that, but they seem to do much better after that. So he gave them a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
And it also raised the family's profile within the geological community. So they started realizing, oh, it's this one family that's collecting all of these fossils that are really cool. And so Mary kept on hunting fossils, and collecting them was dangerous winter work. So mostly in the winter when there's these big storms, as soon as a storm ends, you go, and hopefully most of the stuff that's going to fall has already fallen. So there's lots of, there's like landslides and so it's very dangerous. And so in 1823, an article in the Bristol Mirror said of her, "This persevering female has for years gone daily in search of fossil remains of importance at every tide, for many hours under the hanging cliffs of lime, whose fallen masses are her immediate object, as they alone contain these valuable relics of a former world, which must be snatched at the moment of their fall, as the continual risk of being crushed by the half-suspended fragments they leave behind, or be left to be destroyed by the returning tide. To her exertions, we owe nearly all of the fine specimens of ichthyosauri of the great collections."
This, like, needs to be a children's movie.
There are so many children's books about her.
I believe that.
Yeah, there's multiple. The risks of her profession were illustrated when on October 1933, she went out to collect some fossils, and she barely avoided being killed by a landslide, but it buried her black and white terrier.
No.
Trey.
Oh, Trey.
Who was her constant companion and always went out with her to fossil hunt.
Oh.
I know.
Trey's like a sleazebag name.
But it's T-R-A-Y.
Oh.
I know. I don't know. It's British.
British, yeah. I ain't on the British.
So, as Annie... Yeah. And then she was like, oh, I'm just gonna keep doing
well,
this.
Well, she's probably like, oh, he'll just be another fossil.
I'll come back in a couple of years. So, as Anning continued to make important finds, her reputation grew, and on December 10th, 1823, she found the first complete plesiosaurus ever discovered. So, yeah, she found the first plesiosaurus. And when Connie Bear, I don't think that's how you say his name, when he presented his analysis of the plesiosaur anatomy to the meeting of the Geological Society in 1924, he again failed to mention Annie by name. So he didn't say who had found these fossils. Even though she had possibly collected both skeletons, and she had made the sketch of the second skeleton he used in his presentation. So she had found all the bones, put them together, drawn up what she thought the organism looked like, gave it to him, and then he did not credit her. Which, I mean, I think it's the way it was.
Yeah.
So, I'm not trying to, like, malign him specifically, but that's just, like, that's the way it was.
It could also be that she was a kid, right? Like, maybe that was part of it.
1811, she was 12. So,
1823,
she was 24.
I missed the dates.
Yeah.
Okay.
Connie Bear, his presentation was It was made at the same meeting at which William Buckland described the dinosaur Megalosaurus, and I guess the combination created a sensation in scientific circles. So this is when they're finding all of these giant dinosaurs, or you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're just extinct animals.
Extinct animals. And
all of them are dinosaurs.
Yeah, so the second fossil that Mary Anning found was named and described as Plesiosaurus dolichidius. It's the type specimen of the species that she found. So it's a super important find.
That's so cool.
And so this presentation by Connie Bear followed after, what am I trying to say? Followed the resolution of a controversy over the legitimacy of one of the fossils. So I guess the fact that the plesiosaur's long neck had an unprecedented 35 vertebra, so it's that really long.
Yeah, I just, maybe this part.
Yeah.
We can upload this somewhere at some point.
So all those vertebrae raise the suspicions of the French anatomist Georges Cuvier, when he reviewed Anning's drawings of the second skeleton, and he wrote to Connie Bear suggesting the possibility that the find was fake, produced by combining fossil bones from different kinds of animals.
Wow.
And so fraud was far from unknown between 19th century fossil collectors. And if the controversy had not been resolved properly and quickly, which was done by Connie Bear during his presentation, the accusation could have seriously damaged Anning's ability to sell fossils to other geologists. Because nobody's going to, if they think she's faking,
she's making it up,
and she's not actually finding these amazing new species, then nobody's going to buy from her.
Can't just take a picture of it, right?
Yeah. So Cuvier's accusation was had resulted in a special meeting of the Geological Society in 1824, which after some debate, they had concluded that the skeleton was legitimate. So that kind of put that rumor to rest.
Wow.
And then Cuvier later admitted that he had acted in haste and was mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once no one agrees with him, confident man is like, oh, I acted in haste.
So Anning discovered yet another important and nearly complete plesiosaur skeleton in 1830 in the same area. So, like,
why aren't there more people, like, just, I don't know, I'm surprised more people
didn't start going
go
out
there, yeah, and go to that same spot.
I guess it's very dangerous still.
Well, she's a brave little...
She's a very brave lady. And
what's the electric shock to just put that energy in her?
No fear. And it was named Plesiosaurus macrocephalus, I can say that one, by William Buckland, and was described in an 1840 paper by Richard Owen. So she never actually wrote any official paper on all the findings she had, selling or giving these fossils to male geologists who then wrote them up. And sometimes credited her and sometimes didn't.
That's crazy. So they bought them.
Yeah,
or,
for the most part,
okay.
Or like a collector would buy them from her and then someone would then buy it or get it or like do research on it from the collector.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So once again, Richard Owen mentioned that wealthy gentlemen who had purchased the fossil and made it available for examination. So he mentioned the people who he had bought it from, but not the woman who had discovered and prepared it, which was Marianne.
Yeah.
And then in 1828, the first British example of the flying reptiles known as pterosaurs,
yeah.
Called a flying dragon, when it was displayed in the British Museum. So she found a squalaraha fish skeleton.
Why did people name shit like that? And now we still have to do it. Calling things like Bob Joe 2.
It's all based on Latin, mostly.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so this fish skeleton that she found in 1829 attracted attention because it had characteristics intermediate between sharks and rays.
Wow.
Which was a big deal.
Yeah.
So, despite her limited education, she read as much of the scientific literature as she could obtain, and often laboriously hand-copied papers borrowed from others. And she also dissected modern animals, including both fish and cuttlefish, to gain a better understanding of the anatomy of some of the fossils which she was working with. So she was really trying to get at the science and trying to being able to identify and put all these fossils together. And Lady Harriet Sylvester, the widow of the former recorder of the City of London, visited Lyme in 1824 and described Anning in her diary and said, "The extraordinary thing in this young woman is that she has made herself so thoroughly acquainted with the science that the moment she finds any bones, she knows to what tribe they belong. She fixes the bones to a frame with cement and then makes drawings and has them engraved. It is certainly a wonderful instance of divine favor that this poor ignorant girl should be so blessed, for by reading and application she has arrived to that degree of knowledge as to be in the habit of writing and talking with professors and other clever men on the subject, and they all acknowledge that and they all acknowledge that she understands more of the science than anyone else in this kingdom.
Yes, thank you. Acknowledgement at last.
So in 1826, she's 27. So she's 27.
Oh my god!
And they're like,
that
she knows.
I'm just kidding. I love her. Love her. That was a joke.
She saved enough money to open up a storefront called Anning's Fossil Depot.
Why doesn't this still exist? We should start a store and franchise it.
In that store, I think they've made a museum to her life. Actually, in Lyme Regis.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
But in the store, she has a full ichthyosaur skeleton on display. Just like...
Of course.
Hanging out.
Oh my god.
Can you... It's like 17 feet in this little storefront.
Wow.
And it's displayed, and many geologists and fossil collectors come from Europe and the Americas just to visit this little shop.
Aww.
Including the geologist George...
I think she's 12.
She is now 27.
Sorry.
So some geologist, George William Featherstonehaugh, called Anning a very clever, funny creature.
Okay.
Okay, so she has the store, and so with this she became more confident in her knowledge and skills, and, like, people are flying all over. Or not... Not flying.
All of a sudden,
shipping,
humans could fly.
Shipping themselves all across the world.
Right.
To come to her store. And she's becoming more confident in her knowledge and skills. And in 1839, so I think she's like 30, she's almost 40, she wrote in the Magazine of Natural History to question the claim made in an article that a recently discovered fossil of the prehistoric shark Hybodus represented a new genus, and she, as an error, since she had discovered the existence of fossil sharks from with both straight and hooked teeth many years ago. So this is, I think, her only, like, formally published writing, like, in the scientific literature, is to be like, no, this isn't a whole new genus. I found these already.
Oh, my gosh.
And the extract from the letter that the magazine printed was the only writing that Anning published in the scientific literature during her lifetime. And as a working-class woman in Britain, Anning was considered an outsider to the scientific community, so they respected her, and they came to visit her and wanted to see her shop and wanted her findings, but she was still an outsider. And at the time, British women could not vote, hold public office, or attend university. And additionally... the increasingly influential Geological Society of London did not allow women to become members or to even attend their, like, lecture parties or whatever as guests. So she's completely out from the Geological Society, and most of them are, like, a lot of them are basing their, like, big findings on things that she has found.
Which they didn't find.
No, yeah. But so they're, you know,
I guess
describing them.
Placing them in
history. So they're doing important things,
right.
But she's providing a lot of the raw material for that and not getting credited.
Wow.
And so, although Anning knew more about fossils and geology than many of the wealthiest fossilists to whom she sold, it was always the gentleman geologist who published the scientific descriptions of the specimens she found and often neglected to mention her name. And she became resentful of this, as you might expect. And Anna Piney, a young woman who sometimes accompanied Anning when she collected, wrote, "She says the world has used her ill. These men of learning have sucked her brains and made a great deal of published works of which she furnished the contents while she derived none of the advantages." So she's still pretty poor and living in Lyme. And so William Buckland, who lectured on geology at the University of Oxford, often visited Lyme on his Christmas vacations and often went fossil hunting with Anning. So people are, when they see her, I think, are interacting with her as kind of a colleague, but she's still barred from a lot of these things. So the Swiss paleontologist Louis Agassiz,
it's okay.
visited Lyme Regis in 1834 and worked with Annie to obtain and study fish fossils found in the region. And he was so impressed by her and her friend Elizabeth Philpot Hat.
Yes.
He wrote
that
in his...
like a Harry Potter name.
It's very British. He wrote in his journal, "Miss Philpot and Mary Anning have been able to show me with utter certainty which are the ichthyodorulite dorsal fins of sharks." These dorsal fins of sharks.
Yeah.
That correspond to different types. So she's really taking out geologists and teaching them... like, helping them find things and teaching them what is what, because she spent so much time out there. And he thanked both of them for their help in his book, Studies of Fossil Fish. So they got an acknowledgement in that.
Good.
So that's nice. And so Annie's correspondence include Charles Lyell, who wrote to her to ask her opinion on how the sea was affecting the coastal cliffs around Lyme, as well as Adam Sedgwick, one of her earliest customers, who taught geology at the University of Cambridge and who numbered Charles Darwin among his students. So she has a lot of influence and had a lot of interactions with really the people that we might hear about more in history
like
classes.
Like Richard Owen, Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So she suffered another serious financial setback in 1835 when she lost most of her life savings in a bad investment. And so, concerned about her financial situation, her old friend William Buckland, who she went out a couple times, she went out with to go collecting, persuaded the British Association for the Advancement of Science and the British government to award her an annuity? Annuity?
I just don't know.
Known as a civil list pension in return for her many contributions to the science of geology. So they started paying her for all the great, important findings and help she had given. So she got a £25 annual pension, which gave her a certain amount of financial security. And Anning died from breast cancer at the age of 47 on 9th of March, 1847. And her work had tallied off during the last few years of her life, as you might imagine, because of her illness. But some of the townsfolk misinterpreted the effects of her increasing doses of laudanum, which is, like, a really intense painkiller, which I also think makes you really high. So she was taking a lot of laudanum for her pain, but people started gossiping online that she had a drinking problem, and that's why she wasn't collecting.
No problems.
Yeah. Small towns.
Yeah.
So the regard in which she was held by the geologic community was shown in 1846 when, upon learning of her cancer diagnosis, the Geological Society raised money from its members to help her with her expenses, and the council of the newly created Dorset County Museum made her an honorary member. And she was buried on the 15th of March in the churchyard of St. Michael's, which was the local parish church, and members of the Geological Society contributed to a stained glass window in her memory, which was unveiled in 1850. So during her lifetime and after her lifetime, the Geological Society, even though they, I don't know if they ever let her in.
Yeah. Doesn't sound like it.
They recognized how important she was. Okay. So here's some of kind of her larger impact. That she's made. Vertebrate fossil finds, especially of marine reptiles, made Annie's reputation, but she made numerous other contributions to early paleontology. So in 1826, she discovers what appears to be a chamber containing dried ink inside a belemnite fossil. And she showed it to her friend Elizabeth Philpot, who was able to revivify the ink.
What are any of these words?
Ink?
No, revivify.
I brought it back? Re-lifed it?
I guess.
She revivified.
What's the difference between revivify and revive?
I don't know. Okay, it's okay. She revivified the ink and used it to illustrate some of her own ichthyosaur fossils. So I guess she, like, turned it from a solid to a liquid again. And then could use it to write. And soon other local artists were doing the same, and as more such fossilized ink chambers were discovered, Annie noted how closely the fossilized chambers resembled the ink sacs of modern squid and cuttlefish.
Of course she noticed that.
Which she had dissected to understand the anatomy of fossil cephalopods. And this led William Buckland to publish the conclusion that Jurassic bolemnites had used ink for defense, just as modern cephalopods do.
I'm just even picturing her, like, going out into the ocean, or I guess, like, squid cephalopods will wash up on shore sometimes, but it's, I don't know, she just, is Lyme Regis just teeming with, like, cephalopods all over the beach, or she's just there all the time?
I mean, she's there all the time.
Or do you think she's, like, swimming in the water?
just grabbing them.
I don't know. She just seems so, like, magical and cool.
Yeah. I don't know. I would imagine they were common than they are now. And so they probably wash up more. So she probably just had... Also, she probably could get them from fishermen. Like, fishermen go out, and she might have been able to, like...
Yeah, whatever. They're some bycatch or something. Yeah.
I don't know how much calamari people are eating at this time. So she did that, and then it was also Annie who noticed that the oddly shaped fossils that were known as bezoar stones were sometimes found in the abdominal region of ichthyosaur skeletons. So that's, I think, how she realized that they were duty.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So she noted that if such stones were broken open, they often contained fossilized fish bones and scales, and sometimes bones from small ichthyosaurs. And so Annie suspected that the stones were fossilized feces and suggested that to Buckland in 1824. And then after further investigation and comparison with similar fossils found in other places, Buckland published that conclusion in 1829 and named them coprolites, which I said.
Yeah.
And then in contrast to the finding of the plesiosaur skeletons a few years earlier, for which she was not credited, when Buckland presented his findings of coprolites in the Geological Society, he mentioned Annie by name and praised her skill and industry in helping him solve this mystery.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So one of the other things, I don't think I have it written here, but so because she, this whole led to, the coprolite thing led to a whole food web, ability to look at ancient food webs.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking.
So they had a sense of, like, who was eating who and what this actual, like, ecosystem looked like based on now knowing that these were fossilized feces.
Yeah, or even just discovering, like, smaller fish that have gone extinct.
Yeah. So, Annie's discoveries also became key pieces of evidence for extinction. So, George's Cuvier had argued for the reality of extinction in the late 1790s.
Argued for the reality of extinction. I can't even imagine a time where we don't know
that things can go extinct.
Yeah.
So this people didn't know that extinction was a thing.
Of course. Yeah.
And so, yeah, he had argued for extinction in the late 1790s based on his analysis of fossils of mammals such as mammoths.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, until the early 1820s, it was still believed by many scientifically literate people that just as new species did not appear, so existing ones did not become extinct. As we all know, new species do not appear. In part because they felt that extinction would imply that God's creation had been imperfect. So nobody wanted to think that. And any oddities found were explained away by belonging to animals still living somewhere in an unexplored region of Earth, as we kind of talked about before.
Yeah, right.
But the bizarre nature of the fossils that Annie found and how big they were and how they didn't look at all like anything...
Yeah.
That existed today, such as the plesiosaur, struck a major blow against this idea. And so people started thinking that maybe extinction does exist.
Yeah.
And these things don't exist now. And so ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, and pterosaurs, she found all of those. And along with the first dinosaur fossils, which were discovered by Gideon Mantell and William Buckland during the same period, showed that during previous eras, the Earth was inhabited by creatures very different from those living today, and provided important support for another controversial suggestion of Cuvier's that there had been an age of reptiles when reptiles, rather than mammals, had been the dominant form of animal life. So she's really in, like, all different things. So the only person who did name a species after her during her lifetime was the Swiss-American naturalist Louis, who I can't pronounce again, Agassiz. Agassiz? In the early 1840s, he named two fossil fish species after her, Acrotis aningia and Belenostomus aningia. And another after her friend Elizabeth Philpott. Aunt Agassiz was grateful for her help, for the help that the women had given him in examining fossil fish specimens during his visit to Lyme Regis in 1834. And after her death, other species, including the ostracod, I'm not going to keep reading these. Let's just say an ostracod, two genera of terapsid reptile, and the bivalve mollusk, and a bivalve mollusk were named in her honor. Oh, some other things were named in her honor.
I believe
point blank, let's just move on. In 2012, the plesiosaur genus Aninosaura was named for her, and the species Ichthyosaurus aninga was named for her in 2015. In March 2010, as part of the celebration of the Royal Society's 350th anniversary, they invited a panel of experts to produce a list of the 10 British women who have most influenced the history of science, and Anning was on the list. That is the story of Mary Anning.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love her. I wish I could know her.
I know. There's so many, like, clever, there's so many paintings of her. And she just looks like such a badass.
I believe
it's like
it.
Her little dog.
Oh, Trey.
And her just, like, on the cliffs. That's all I got.
Yeah, I know. I'm like...
Seashells. She sells seashells.
I had no idea that was about Mary Anning.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, that's the story of Mary Anning. And I started to read this book called The Fossil Hunter, which is actually really entertaining like, addicting. So, if you want to know, like, a more in-depth thing about Mary Anning's life, I think that's a really good source.
That's so cool.
Yeah. All right. Your turn. I'm done.
Okay.
I'm out.
All right. I guess this is when we transition to the next part of our podcast.
Do you have your little sounds?
Yeah.
Okay.
My little sounds.
I won't mean to be diminutive.
These are really important sound bites. Yeah. That's a joke. It's a bad joke. Okay. So, yeah. So, while the first part of our show focuses on women who have made history, we also want to be sure to give shout-outs to women that are making history today. Or should I say herstory?
No.
I'll never say it.
No, you should.
Only
because
I can't say it with a straight face, even though I appreciate people who use it.
Oh, do people say that?
Yeah, like her story instead of his story.
I didn't realize
really?
That history it's was so from nice. His story. Wait, is that
I
really
don't actually
true?
Know if that's the etymology of history, but I think, like, feminists worldwide have tried to make herstory a thing, and it's just never really caught on. Anyway. Moving on. This next segment... I don't know. Am I going to do this? Okay.
You're on it.
So we're giving shout-outs to cool ladies from today in our next segment called Women Who...
Work, 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 work.
That's right, it's the Women Who Work.
Work, 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 work.
Just like Rihanna, there's a lot of female scientists that I'm extremely proud of.
Just like Rihanna, there's some female scientists that you're extremely... Is Rihanna
no,
a female
sorry,
scientist you're extremely...
female I'm extremely proud of. Oh, this is off to a bad start already. We'll see if we do that in the future or not. Yeah, so basically in this segment, like, one of us will give a rundown of some cool experiments published recently that either involve women researchers or projects that were led by women researchers, or maybe talk about a woman who wins, like, a Nobel Prize or, like, gets inducted into the National Academy. Anyway, shout outs to cool sciencey ladies, essentially.
I love it.
Yeah, so we'll see how this works. Okay. So I picked this first group of researchers because I think the study is pertinent to starting a podcast.
Oh, God. Okay.
Because it's likely we're going to say stupid things or do stupid things all the time. And these three women, Li Jiang, Amy Drolet, and Carol Scott, published a paper in the journal Motivation and Emotion this week, showing that you can overcome embarrassment by taking the perspective of an observer.
Okay.
So, are you feeling embarrassed yet?
I've been embarrassed for the past hour. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so their study showed that if you try to take the perspective of somebody watching you rather than the perspective of the embarrassed person,
mm-hmm.
or the person doing something embarrassing, you're less likely to feel embarrassed.
Okay, but are you embarrassed right now?
Yeah, because I can't get out of my head.
Okay, but like if I try to be you, that's not going to happen either.
Not me, it's someone observing
but
us.
We're the
like
only people here.
Like a podcast listener,
oh,
if I think of our listeners.
Okay. In the future observing us, not now observing
us. I kind of assume there will be listeners that...
No, point blank. I kind of assume there will be listeners.
Yeah, right. That was the end of that sentence. You're right. No more.
No, continue.
Okay, but their study was kind of funny, but also really interesting. So they made people watch ads in which someone had something embarrassing happen to them.
Okay.
So one of the ads, a woman is in a yoga... This is an ad for Beano, which I think makes you fart less. Like, I don't know, it seems like fun, honestly,
yeah.
Which women are great at having fun.
Beano sounds like fun?
No.
Or this is...
The study, doing the study
yeah.
sounds
uh-huh.
like fun. So they had their study participants watch videos, a video. So one group of them watched a video where a woman was in a yoga class and does downward facing dog. Did she fart? And so, they saw there's sort of a spectrum of people that are really self-conscious and feel embarrassment.
Watching some other
woman.
Yeah,
just
fart.
Watching,
mm-hmm.
right.
Yeah, that would be me.
Okay. They led them through a lot of different scenarios like this.
Mm-hmm.
And in some scenarios, they instructed some of the participants to remind themselves that it's like not them like
uh-huh.
to be that they're an observer and like it's not happening to them kind
so of. Like I am not farting.
Okay, I should say like we're experts in one field,
very specific
yeah
field.
So it's hard for me maybe to describe all some of these studies, but anyway, I don't exactly reading through, I couldn't understand all of the jargon, so this is my own interpretation.
I like it.
That they sort of instructed some of the people to picture themselves as observers of a situation, not as being directly involved in it, which technically they were observers.
Yeah.
And when they did this, those observers felt less embarrassment, like reported to feel less embarrassment.
Okay.
And they also found, and okay, this is just a side note. I'm just saying this is advice for us as podcasters. But anyway, they also found, because these are researchers in a marketing field, that people are more likely to buy a product if they feel embarrassed watching an ad.
That they will?
Yeah.
Buy a thing if they're embarrassed?
Yeah, even for the person.
Why?
If they, you know, I don't know. But maybe they can just empathize so much with that person that they're like, I need this product too.
I gotta have it.
I gotta have Beano. Isn't that interesting?
I gotta have Beano. Beano, sponsor of Stem
Fatale. So if you're ever like, so advice corner, if you're ever watching an ad and you feel embarrassed and you're like, I need this product, just be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm an observer, I'm not actually embarrassed, and maybe you won't want
okay.
as much. So that's just another cool thing.
That's good to know.
Anyway, so, yeah. Go Lee, go Carol, and go Amy. That's a dope study. That's my shout out number one. And the rest is shorter. Okay.
I am not farting.
What?
I'm just...
Are you farting?
No, I'm telling myself.
Oh, yeah.
I'm taking the advice of the study and trying to calm my nerves.
I know, yeah. It's weird that they had to instruct people to think of themselves as observers.
I think I want to see a follow-up study where they give people a lot of beans, make them do yoga, and record them farting, and then make them watch themselves farting versus watching someone else farting and seeing.
It's a great idea.
Very embarrassing.
I would not sign up for that study unless I was getting paid a lot. Also, yeah,
that's
a really good idea.
Is it?
Okay. Well, this is why we're not studying marketing, probably.
No.
You put up a sign that just says, hey, want to fart in a yoga class? Technically, sometimes everyone has wanted to fart in a yoga class and they felt like it was socially unacceptable. So maybe...
There's goat yoga. I'm sure we could find something that's just like... Fart yoga.
Let's start fart yoga. Fart all you want. And everyone just goes namaste.
Yeah. But also it's super loud in there so no one can hear. And there's just a lot of fans and a lot of Febreze.
Lots of fans.
It's just like,
yeah.
Fart till you drop yoga.
No.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Another good news study coming our way.
Uh-huh.
So this was a study published in Science this week, and there was like 12 authors on the study, but the first author and the last author were both women, and
woo-hoo.
Those are the most powerful positions in authorship
on true.
Paper. And they were kind of quoted the most
mm-hmm.
in different press releases. So... Jamie Voiles and Corinne Richards-Zawaki, they published a study this week that found, stating that about 12% of frogs in Panama, which is 9 species, seem to be recovering from massive population decline. So out of about like 80 species, 9 seem to be recovering from massive population decline.
Okay.
Starting like 20 years ago, researchers have seen amphibian population sizes decline substantially, most likely due to chytrid fungus
mm-hmm.
That like infects the skin cells of frogs, so they don't
excrete
waste.
And I think it's hard for them to breathe.
Yeah, hard for them to breathe. Yeah,
because they breathe through their skin.
Yeah,
it's all bad. It's all bad.
So chytrid fungus has been spreading rapidly around the world. I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
killing frogs all over the damn place.
Yeah.
And it's been really, really sad. So it's cool to see that some frogs might be rebounding
mm-hmm.
from this infection, though it's not most species. And in this study, they also show that the frog species that are recovering did so as a result of changes in their skin cells, potentially.
Oh, okay.
So, like, maybe the frogs are evolving
mm-hmm.
in response to the infection rather than the infection itself. Like, the fungus itself isn't changing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it becoming less pathogenic?
Yeah.
But possibly the frogs are evolving. But something else that I read said it could also be due to, like, changes in climate, and that climate change might be helping frogs in the short term, even though
mm-hmm.
in the long term it's not going to be good for anything.
Yeah.
But possibly, like, warmer weather or less rain or something is helping them right now.
Yeah, like, slightly drier habitats. Because
mm-hmm.
I know chytrid... I thought chytrid liked warm, wet.
You know, I honestly have no idea.
I could ask my lab mate, but it's fine.
Yeah. So, anyways, congrats, ladies.
Yeah.
That's great news. We're all rooting for you, and we're all
rooting for the
frogs.
Yeah.
Okay, last one, and this one's just sort of cool.
Cool.
I mean, they're all really cool.
Yeah.
This is the last one.
Hit me.
Jessica Fuji, a researcher at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, first author on a cool paper published this week in Peer Day, detailing evidence that sea turtles use their limbs in foraging and feeding.
What are they doing?
Okay. I don't know. You should read this paper
because
it's really cool. But they'll use their... So they just, like, they heard and seen in videos, like, sea turtles using their limbs to, like, carry food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, over distances or,
Like, what kind of food? Like,
what do sea turtles eat? They eat mollusks and maybe some small fish.
Okay.
But, yeah, that's a good question. Definitely, like, shellfish.
Okay.
And they'll also do behaviors like, so they saw like, or heard through the grapevine, whatever, that that someone had like observed sea turtles doing this foraging behavior.
Okay.
And so this study is sort of a meta-analysis of a ton of like sea critter cams and papers that talk about sea turtle foraging, which I'm like, hi, I want to do, just watch like sea turtles for hours. That sounds awesome.
It's gotta be so much video footage.
I know, that gets a little boring.
Per, like, data point.
It's a great undergrad project. Just watch the ocean for 5 hours.
Hopefully you'll see one sea turtle.
A flipper, like, in the corner.
Holding a fish.
Right.
Yeah.
So they found that sea turtles do things like, they sweep dust around on the bottom floor so that prey will kind of get like stirred up and be easier to catch.
Aww.
They carry things, and there's a lot of other behaviors, but they also talked about a behavior that dolphins do called kerplunking. That sounds totally cute. Where dolphins slap the water surface with their tail to cause a startle response in prey to capture. And there's been like one thing like published on that.
Okay.
But I think
so they like body slam the water and shock fish.
Yeah, so they do like this this behavior called corralling where they use one or both flippers to guide loose food in a directed manner towards their mouth. Like all of these behaviors that have never really been before, and it sort of adds to growing literature on just like sea creatures using their limbs for feeding and
not
foraging,
just
and rather than
swimming.
Just to swim.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Which is really, really cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah. So Jessica, if you're listening, good job.
Good job.
Publish more papers on kerplunking, please. And if you want to get us a job, your job sounds cool.
Yeah. If you're looking for a postdoc.
Yeah. So that's shout-outs for the week.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
Kerplunking, farting, all of the great verbing.
And frogs are coming back.
And frogs are coming back.
Or some of them, at least. Which is good news.
Yeah. Did you have...
I do have a trivia question.
wait,
okay.
I have to...
It's like a softball, since this is our first ever...
Yeah, make us feel good.
Yeah. And I think, we'll just, we'll let people look it up and then we'll answer it next week?
Yeah, we'll totally come back to it. Okay, wait, so this is our question.
Got some questions that I gotta ask.
Who was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, and for what?
Marie Curie?
Yeah.
Remember when I said I don't quite know what Marie Curie... Wait, so Rosalind Franklin... helped discover DNA, right?
Yeah, she did the
Marie Curie.
Well, let's let everybody look it up for next week.
Next week, please tell me what she did.
Easily Googleable. We'll have to figure out how to do this better. I mean, this was a low-hanging fruit also.
But yet I could only answer half of it.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
I think that's it. Okay, I had things I was supposed to say at the end.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Whenever this goes up, you should write us a review on iTunes.
Yeah.
Because we want to be
number
one.
Oh, but listen to a couple first.
Yeah.
Just in case
this is a good one and then the other ones suck.
Oh.
Or the opposite. Oh, you mean the other way.
Yeah, if you like this, write a review immediately.
Yeah, and if you don't, listen to a couple
more.
Try
out some more.
We might get a Twitter or something. That was an important note.
Yes.
And then, oh, our theme song is called Mary Annie. It's not going to be as thematic it's going to be the same song every week.
Right, but we won't talk about Mary Annie.
We won't talk about Mary Annie every week, though we could.
It seems like there's a lot there to explore.
She's a great lady. And it's by the band Artichoke.
Yeah.
Our Trey. R.I.P. Trey.
R.I.P. everybody.
So I think that's it. You can follow us. So I am Ecology Gremlin. GREMLYN is how you spell gremlin in this case. Ecology_gremlin.
Yeah.
I don't know what yours is.
Well, yeah, I'll say it.
Oh, okay,
cool. Yeah, you can, until we get our joint pod Twitter, you can follow me on Twitter at EmmaDietrich89, which is EmmaDietrich89.
And if you have a lady you want us to go over,
yeah, if you have
suggestions or like
female scientists,
yeah, current or past,
yeah,
you can tweet at us, and then we'll maybe put it in the podcast. And if you tweet about the show, we'll acknowledge you at the next show. So please tweet about us.
Yeah, or if you say nice things.
Yeah, say nice things about us.
Yeah.
Okay. Stroke our egos.
Oh, constructive criticism?
Also good.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Mean things, not welcome.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye.